Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Anthropology on the New Books Podcast Network. I'm Jacob Doherty, the host for this episode. Today, we're talking to Sophia Stamatopoulou Robbins, assistant professor of anthropology at Bard College and author of Waste Siege, The Life of Infrastructure in Palestine, published in 2020 by Stanford University Press. The book is an ethnography of Palestinian life under occupation that takes waste infrastructure as a starting point for exploring how Palestinians deal with toxicity and uncertainty, how governance happens under conditions of occupation, and the everyday moral economies through which goods circulate and ethical selves are constructed. Congratulations on a fantastic book, Sophia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Before we delve into the book itself, can you tell us a bit about your background and how you came to anthropology and the origins of this project?
Yeah, sure. So I started my PhD in anthropology at Columbia University in 2006. And I ended up soon thereafter taking a class with Partha Chatterjee, which was on Gramsci and Foucault. And that class coincided with the kind of commentary that came out of Hamas, the Palestinian Islamist movement, winning the Palestinian legislative elections in January of 2006. And the commentary that I noted as I decided to write my paper for that class on Hamas was circulated around this idea that Palestinians were probably not becoming radical Islamists. There was a kind of, and the commentaries I'm talking about here are coming out of the West and people who are sort of in the center politically or to the left who were hoping that they were seeing something other than the Islamization of Palestine in this election victory of Hamas. So the comments were really circling around this idea that infrastructure and social welfare were what were missing from Palestinians' experiences of governance as they had been governed so far by the opposition party, which was Fatah. And the thing that struck me most about this set of comments was that it sort of simplified politics, electoral politics, but politics in general, down to this idea that anyone who believed anything would vote for someone they disagreed with as long as they were offering something like street sweeping or food distribution. And I thought that seemed like a simplification and didn't resonate with the ways we tend to think about politics as much more complicated than in the global north. So this set me down a path of thinking about how infrastructure and social welfare are experienced in Palestine. And I was especially interested because Palestinians have lacked a state for, as long as the modern Palestinian people have existed. So you can't sort of imagine a predictable set of expectations being attached to a state or to a government if there has been the absence of this kind of experience of statehood for such a long time. So I should follow up from that to say that I started thinking at that point about infrastructure, but it was a bit accidental that I chose to work on waste infrastructures. Partly it was a decision made because I was thinking that some elements of Palestinian experiences of infrastructures were actually quite well represented in the literatures by various disciplines and by NGOs, for example, water and electricity. And I expected that if I were to go to Palestine and start asking questions about water infrastructures, as an outsider, I would probably receive relatively rehearsed, understandably rehearsed answers, which would sort of revolve around the fact that Israelis are stealing Palestinian water or control electricity. I thought that if I chose a topic like waste, I would find people sort of more open to thinking with me or more surprised to be talking about the mundane. So the waste kind of decision at the end of that infrastructure journey was a bit coincidental, but ended up opening a lot of avenues of kind of research and thinking afterwards that were pretty surprising.
So that gets into my next question, which is really, given how many ways there are to think about and study the occupation, why waste? Why make waste the central one for you? And what makes the politics of garbage and sewage and secondhand goods such a rich venue for understanding both the occupation from the position of ordinary Palestinians, as well as the kinds of governance and that mediate relations between the population and the absent state?
Yeah, so I think I want to point to three things to answer that question. One is that I was really interested at the time, this is in the 2007-8-9 period, in thinking with people like Bruno Latour about how we can kind of shake up the usual units we look at when we look at any kind of cultural or political phenomenon. So in the case of Palestine, as you're saying, there are many ways to think about Palestine, but also Palestine has tended to sort of, understandings of Palestine have tended to fall under certain tropes that involve assuming specifically that nationalism or ideology in general are kind of determining factors in why people feel the way they feel or behave the way they behave, or on the flip side, that sort of resource scarcity taken as an ontological given is what structures the quote-unquote conflict, which I don't tend to call a conflict. So I thought that following the thing, which I borrow from science and technology studies, in this case waste, would allow me to sort of watch an object or a set of objects move across space and across institutions and actors to understand what possibly unlikely alliances of actors and institutions are actually shaping life at the scale of the everyday. So this is me also trying to push against the kind of overdetermination of diplomatic politics in understanding Palestinian life, or for that matter, of major kind of obvious political events like protests or signings of agreements. So I guess one way to put this is that I've also felt that Palestine is understood often as a kind of layer cake where you have the occupation on top, the Palestinian Authority in the middle, and then the Palestinian population as a kind of general body. And I thought following waste across those sections of the cake, but also into corners like Palestinian municipalities or settlements, or for that matter, Japanese aid agencies, you know, would help us understand something more kind of realistic about the way life unfolds in Palestine. So that's point one. Another point is that I thought, you know, Palestinian life and Palestine in general has been presented as exceptional or unique, and therefore a place from which it's hard to think about other contexts, although, of course, the growing interest in comparative settler colonial studies has undermined that. But in general, if Palestine is seen as universal and, as exceptional and unique, it also means that some of the mundane elements of life are less visible. So I thought waste, whatever we think in anthropology of how culturally constructed it is, and I think it is in many ways, is nevertheless a somewhat universal feature of life. So looking at Palestinian waste experiences would be a way also to help think about Palestinian life in comparative terms. And then the last thing I was going to say about that is that modern waste has been at the center of understandings of the modern state, often seen as the site of negotiation or definition of the line between public and private. You know, some people have argued that the modern state exists as a kind of, I mean, this is Dominique Laporte with his History of Shit, I'm thinking, that the modern state exists as the body that regulates the relationship between people and waste. But again, those kinds of arguments are based on the idea that there is a state in the first place, or that, you know, the modern state will look a certain way or has certain features. And I thought it would be very interesting to think about what things like discipline or surveillance or hygiene or morality, for that matter, look like when the central state is not actually central in controlling the way that waste is managed.
One of the concepts that's really jumped out at me, and going back to what you were saying about the growing presence of settler colonial studies in understanding this, is that the way that the concept of wasteland has been a recurrent feature of colonialism and occupation and racial displacement, not only in Palestine, but also in a lot of other contexts around the world. So can you expand a little bit on what some of the key concepts or the key aspects of this wasteland rhetoric have been in the colonial environmental imaginary and how it's taken shape, particularly in Palestine?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things is that wastelands can be two almost opposite types of territory. One is the wasteland as a kind of empty space that can be filled by colonial rule or colonial inputs of various kinds. And the other is wasteland as a space that is full in some sense, but mismanaged, so that the indigenous population is viewed as the mismanager of that space. And I think both of those types or versions of wasteland were key to Zionist settlement of Palestine. And in that sense, also were not unique, because I think these were fundamental ways of thinking about places like Australia, Canada, the US as they were being settled. I think the interesting thing for me is that the latter version, both versions have been key to much more recent settler and colonial expansion into the West Bank, except maybe with the kind of addition of, or the slight tweaking of the latter form, which is that the indigenous population, the Palestinians, are often viewed as lacking in environmental expertise or awareness. That is, that they are viewed as people who lack the capacity to know the land in the right way and to know its future in specific ways. And this new version of the environmental imaginary is attached to specific versions of environmentalism that grew out of the 1970s and then kind of were written into the Oslo Accords in the 1990s, which is also to say that this is an environmental imaginary now shared by a lot of international donors who fund the Palestinian Authority, which means that the Palestinian Authority, which is now in a position to actually try to manage some aspects of the land by managing waste, is in the position of having to convince both donors and the Israeli government and other interested parties in Israel, like environmental NGOs, that the Palestinian Authority is environmentally friendly, or that it knows somehow how to be a proper custodian of the environment. I'm kind of previewing chapter 5 here, and I know we'll get there, but I think This focus on particular forms of expertise is really a very powerful and pernicious part of the environmental imaginary right now, in particular because that expertise is perceived to accrue to a person from specific institutions like university education in the United States or Germany, and also from experience managing infrastructures, both of which Palestinians are often denied precisely because they're under occupation.
So the name of the book is Waste Siege, and I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about that concept and something that you mark out as a kind of historical period, just to get some of the context for when you were conducting your ethnographic research. And yeah, what do you mean by this concept, and what does it refer to in terms of the way that Palestinians were experiencing violence at the time of your work?
Yeah, well, I'll start by saying that there is a kind of provocative implication of my argument in Waste Siege, which is that Palestinians are experiencing waste in a way that can sometimes occlude or elide experiences of direct military violence by the Israelis. And I say it's provocative because it sounds as if I'm saying violence by Israel has been reduced somehow in Palestine, which is not actually what I'm saying, but I do think that it's changed forms. And I think that matters. And I think that change must be understood in parallel to a change in Israel's approach to the West Bank with regard to waste management since it occupied that territory in 1967. So between the 1960s, 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank, and the mid-1990s, one of the things I learned by doing some archival digging into early Israeli planning, infrastructure planning for waste management infrastructures in the West Bank, and also from working at the scale of municipalities in the West Bank, Palestinian municipalities, is that the Israeli authorities treated the West Bank as part of Israel from the perspective of waste management during that first period until the 1990s. So that meant that in the early 1970s, Israel built or approved construction of wastewater treatment plants in several Palestinian West Bank cities. Again, it's worth noting that this probably was cynical in the sense that there was a cholera outbreak in Jerusalem in 1970 or 1971. And that was attributed to the irrigation of vegetables in the West Bank by sewage. So, the motivation for building those wastewater treatment plants or approving them might have been to protect Israeli public health and the tourism industry, which was hit pretty hard from the cholera outbreak. On the other hand, the fact remains that these plants, which were absent before the 1970s, were built and were similar technologies to the technologies that were being built across Israel. And another example is that in the 1980s, Israel began seriously planning sanitary landfills to be built in the West Bank. And the idea was that those would serve both Palestinian communities and settler communities, and that they would sort of mirror similar plans being implemented inside Israel. So Israel was effectively applying Israeli environmental or waste management standards from Israel in the West Bank. Then after the 1990s, when Israel abrogated its governing responsibilities vis-a-vis the Palestinian population in the West Bank, and the Palestinian Authority was established, Israel began obstructing the construction of Palestinian infrastructures, exactly like wastewater treatment plants and garbage disposal infrastructures like incinerators or landfills. And that obstruction continues today. Meanwhile, Israel also began to permit or be much more lax about the dumping of wastes in the West Bank from settlements and from Israel, which I think was also encouraged by the fact that Israeli environmental policy started to become more rigid and waste management became more expensive for a lot of municipalities and industries in Israel. So there was motivation, financial motivation for people, for Israelis to dump their wastes in the West Bank where there was no regulation or very little of it. Finally, or there are a couple more elements to this. Israel has started to prohibit the movement of waste outside of the West Bank into Israel, which was part of the separation of the West Bank from Israel that occurred in the 1990s. And then once the PA was established, part of its goal was to make itself state-like and give the Palestinians it was governing the experience of a kind of normalcy under a state. So there was a decision made to be able to increase imports by Palestinian businesses from anywhere in the world, which happened at the same time as the Palestinian economy was being increasingly undermined. So people had very little money. Business shopkeepers, for example, had very little money. So they would import the cheapest possible goods or cheaper goods than they could find around them, which of course also undermined local industries like shoemaking, for example, that were making higher quality goods. So that was a kind of major economic shift that also meant waste disposable or lower quality goods were flowing into the West Bank at much higher rates and also had nowhere to go. I think I should say something about the change in the nature of violence briefly. One thing to say is that, of course, violence and Israeli control are still alive and well in the West Bank. But I would say that during my period of research, they had shifted notably. So, for example, since I think, the early 2000s, maybe 2006, there have been basically no bombings in the West Bank. Internal checkpoints have been relatively relaxed so that it took me something like 7 hours to get from Ramallah to Jenin in 2007, and that only took me 1.5, an hour and a half to get from Jenin to Ramallah and back during my field work between 2009 and 2016. So the internal checkpoints were relaxed. And then targeted assassinations and arrests, which continue to take place, generally are kind of isolated to a particular house or take place at night. And you don't find Israeli tanks or jeeps or soldiers typically moving through Palestinian urban centers the way they once did. In fact, they were stationed in those centers during the 1980s and before. So these are major shifts in the everyday experience of soldiers and weapons, even if the violence is itself always potentially there. And then in parallel, what I'm saying is that the presence of various wastes became more intense. And what I was most puzzled by and what led me to explore waste as a kind of political problem was that it seemed that the presence of waste was obfuscating certain forms of Israeli domination or leading to confusion about who was responsible for the improvement of everyday life.
So that really comes through in the first chapter, which is called Compression and looks at the construction and modernization of a landfill in Palestine. So can you describe the space and some of the actors who are involved in the management of it and say a bit about how this landfill came to be a national project? Like, what does it mean for waste infrastructure to occupy such a big place in the national imaginary?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I'll say about the national imaginary is that it's certainly not a kind of an agreed upon national imaginary, but certainly a very powerful imaginary for the engineers and environmental experts and other bureaucrats who were working inside the Palestinian Authority and in the joint service councils, which were created by the Palestinian Authority to to sort of run the new centralized waste management schemes that were being implemented. Zahrat al-Finjan landfill is a landfill in the Jenin governorate. It's carved into a piece of agricultural land and is the first sanitary landfill run by the PA in the West Bank. Sanitary landfill just means that it is a dump site where there is lining placed under the waste at the bottom of the crater to create a buffer between the waste and the liquids, particularly from the waste and the earth below it. And it's controlled by a gate and like a fence all around the landfill itself, and then a gate that weighs trucks that come in to determine how much waste is being brought from which municipality. And that whole system is based on a major change that the Palestinian Authority implemented, which is that it closed initially over 85 local municipal dump sites that were situated at the edges of municipalities, forcing those municipalities to now send their waste to this one landfill in the northern West Bank. So the people who actually work there, other than the workers who help drive the compressor machines and work at the weighbridge at the gate, are these engineers who manage the fact that this is a loan-based infrastructure. So they manage the financials of that infrastructure, and they also make sure that all the municipalities are kind of following the regulations of the landfill in terms of what can be brought in and what must be left outside. It is for this group of engineers that I saw the landfill being really a profound political statement. For them, one of the most important things was that the landfill was built in what's called Area C, which is an Oslo era designation of territory. It's about 75% of the West Bank that is entirely controlled by the Israeli government through the Israeli military in the West Bank. So it's almost impossible for a Palestinian individual or institution to build any kind of infrastructure or housing in the Area C areas. So the fact that this landfill was a Palestinian Authority landfill with a Palestinian flag cut into Area C was itself a major coup in some sense. The fact that it was the largest to date waste management infrastructure, that kind of scale made it national in some sense. And the fact that it prevented waste from being deposited across the rest of the territory suggested a kind of national cleanup of that part of the West Bank, and was imagined as significant partly because it was replacing or cleaning up from the direct Israeli occupation that had been in place until the mid-1990s. The fact that the landfill planning is what is considered long-term planning for Palestinians, the 30-year planning of a landfill's lifespan, was also, I think, a major part of that sense that it was a national plan, that kind of longer-term, longer temporality. And then the fact that the engineers were managing major loans from the World Bank and the European Union gave them a sense that they were kind of working at the scale of state building, because these budgets, the $9 million from the World Bank and I think around $4 million from the European Union, were much bigger than any Palestinian who had worked under the Israeli administration would have worked on. And finally, there was some controversy around whether to call this centralization or decentralization, but essentially the landfill did centralize the Palestinian Authority's control over municipalities across the northern West Bank, which had, again, before that, been controlled by Israel. So there was a way in which the landfill provided the opportunity to rearrange the workings of local municipalities.
So you've touched on it a bit there, but the law is a really critical part of the waste management, the construction of waste management infrastructure and the geographies of waste flows in the West Bank. So can you say how the legal infrastructure of occupation functions both to keep waste in the West Bank and to direct Israeli waste there as well?
Yeah, I think one of the most important elements is that the Israeli environmental law or Israeli law in general does not apply to the West Bank. But it's very important to say it's Israeli environmental law, which is, as I said, becoming increasingly strict in relation to pollution and contamination of resources, doesn't apply to the West Bank, which means that for Israelis, the West Bank has become a kind of lawless no man's land where they can dispose of wastes that are otherwise difficult to dispose of. So that in itself has encouraged a certain amount of dumping. And then, you know, I think law is a strange word. The area A, B, and C designations that are very, very important to construction of infrastructures for Palestinians in the West Bank. I should say A and B are both territories where the Palestinian Authority has some authority to, for example, to determine street lighting or to stop traffic violations, but where the Israelis nevertheless maintain control. So the area A, B, and C designations have been fundamental to preventing the construction of Palestinian infrastructures, partly because in area C, which is where Israel maintains full control, that is where most large-scale Palestinian infrastructures would be built because that is those are the areas outside of dense population centers. So those two, I would say areas A, B, and C, that designation and the non-application of Israeli environmental law are the two maybe most important elements regulation-wise that are creating waste siege.
So you write that the landfill isn't just accumulating garbage, but it's also a way of accumulating and making time. So can you explain a bit about what you mean by that and some of the temporal paradoxes that are taking place as waste infrastructure is being modernized?
Yeah. The thing that really interested me once I started thinking seriously about landfills is that they grow over time. And initially I had thought this made waste management infrastructures unique, but I think it's similar, in fact, to what happens to electrical grids, which expand as population centers need more electricity. But landfills grow over time and therefore take more land as they grow, because they fill up with waste. And that is a very challenging thing in a place like Palestine, which is land scarce and where Palestinians, whom the Palestinian Authority was asking, has been asking to give up their lands, are of course going to be sensitive about giving up forever agricultural lands that they would be using for cultivation and for passing wealth on through the generations. So that was the most important challenge that the engineers had to face as they were constructing and operating the landfill in Jenin, which meanwhile was also, as I said, built on a loan that they had to pay back to the World Bank, and the loan was already due. But because they had closed the surrounding dump sites to force municipalities to dispose of their waste at the landfill, when those municipalities were too in debt or poor to actually pay the fees to pay back the loan in the landfill, the operators, the engineers that I spent time with, had to figure out another way to get the money to pay back the loan. And the way they chose was to increase the number of people whose waste was being disposed of there. So they increased it from 200,000, which it was designed for, to 600,000 and then 1 million, which meant that much more waste was coming in. More people were paying, which was helping pay back the loan. But now the landfill was filling up too quickly and decreased in its lifespan from 30 years down to 15, which was very stressful because it meant that the operators were going to have to seek more land to continue burying waste. And one of the solutions they tried to develop for that was to reject certain types of waste. So construction and demolition waste, for example, are very bulky, and they just excluded them from disposal there, which of course sent those wastes out into other spaces because they had to go somewhere. And again, they couldn't leave the West Bank. So they ended up piling up in other parts of the West Bank. But what I found was that the engineers who were dealing with these very complicated dilemmas that were always kind of forced upon them, both by the infrastructure that they had chosen or were forced to put in place, and also by the just ontological fact of wastes accumulating, was that they developed this sense of time that was attached to the lifespan of the landfill. So I call that landfill time. I found them kind of carving out a way to deal with the ethical and political dilemma of having to sort of eat more land. That was both politically a sensitive thing and ethically a sensitive thing when you look at the communities that whose land is being taken. And they would focus in on this these periods of time that were attached to the landfill's lifespan and kind of pause all other questions, including ideals they held about doing recycling and environmental awareness campaigns for a time after the landfill would fill up and ideally be closer to closing. And I guess an important component to point to here is that they felt that their hands were tied in having to construct landfills because Israel wouldn't allow incineration, for example, which takes a lot less land because there were because Israel kind of claimed that there were security concerns around Palestinians having combustion technologies. And the donors like the World Bank and the German government who funded waste management were really hesitant to support technologies like incineration because of the environmental imaginary I mentioned earlier, which in which they imagined that Palestinians lacked the technical know-how to manage these supposedly more sophisticated technologies. So landfill time is that kind of paused temporality that the engineers opened up and held open as they waited for better solutions.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So the next chapter is called Inundation, and it moves us from the landfill to some of the more everyday spaces of the city, where you describe the really lively trade in secondhand Israeli goods that's taking place in the West Bank, visiting this place that's a so-called rubbish market. Before we get too much into the rubbish market itself, can you maybe tell us about the inundation of disposable goods into Palestine and the kinds of planned obsolescence that are the backdrop for the secondhand economies that you're describing?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, that when the Palestinian Liberation Organization signed the Paris Protocol in 1995, that protocol allowed Palestinians to import directly from anywhere for the first time. The choice that was made by kind of the economic imperative of people not having that much cash was to import goods that were of a lower quality in many cases, or in any case perceived to be of a lower quality, partly because they were being regulated by the Palestinian Authority and not the Israeli government. So what I came to realize was that although Israel continues, of course, to control imports and delay a lot of imports at its ports before they get into the West Bank, they are not, the Israeli government is, and customs officials are not controlling for quality. They're controlling for what they see as security related issues. So the goods that were coming in starting in the late 1990s were regulated by the Palestinian Authority, which in which many Palestinians I spoke with had very little faith, and were expiring much more quickly than the goods people had been accustomed to using had expired. So that there was a sense of inundation by the wrong kind of goods, even though there were many goods. So there wasn't an issue of scarcity so much as a scarcity of quality. And at the same time, the enclosure by the wall of the West Bank meant that Palestinians who previously had been able to move through space and shop in places like Haifa or Tel Aviv were now unable to do that. So they were sort of trapped in very specific markets. And that that was fundamental to that feeling of inundation.
So in that context, is discarded Israeli goods become seen as some of the highest quality goods that are available? So can you describe a little bit how those goods come into Palestine? What are the kind of circuits through which the secondhand economy is taking place?
Yeah. So most of the Palestinians who once worked in Israel in construction, for example, and other industries stopped being able to after the enclosure of the West Bank. But a few of them were able to maintain contacts with their employers on the other side of the Green Line in Israel. And so they can obtain Israeli work permits to enter Israel on a regular basis. Those very few West Bank Palestinians, along with some Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship but who live in the West Bank because their spouses are West Bank ID holders and cannot live in Israel, together partner to travel two or three times a week with vans, for example, across checkpoints that separate the West Bank from Israel. And they tend to go to Jaffa's used goods market, to Haifa, and to Jerusalem. Those are the main centers where very, very early in the morning they get dibs on the used goods that are being displayed for largely Israeli consumption. At the peripheries of those markets in Haifa and Jerusalem and Jaffa, there are always also the discards of the used goods markets, so the things that didn't even make it into those used goods markets. And when I followed traders from Jenin who did go to Jaffa, I found that they circulated both inside the Jaffa used goods market itself, collecting and purchasing used goods from Israeli traders, but also collecting discards from the surrounds of that market. And then by, let's say, 2 p.m., they get back to Jenin and circulate around the market, reselling those goods to the Jenin shopkeepers in the used goods market. And I think it captures the process that's taking place around the West Bank.
One of the really interesting points you make is how this story complicates our understandings about waste flows as always a form of colonial dumping. So what do you think we can learn from this to think differently about transnational movements of discards?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the one hand, a lot of consumers or commentators in Palestine, I mean, in Jenin, for example, who talked about the used goods market there, were uncomfortable with those goods becoming kind of domestic objects for Palestinians, while knowing that they had been discarded by Israelis, and many people did speak of them in terms of a kind of colonial dumping or dehumanization or humiliation. On the other hand, a lot of people insisted on seeing them as more of a higher quality and as more valuable than the new goods on the regular market. And I think the fact that the market continues to exist and to grow is a testament to the fact that many people are quite attached to its existence. So I think what we can learn is to take seriously the forms of valuation that our interlocutors undertake or perform as they think about used goods that might even come from the source of their domination. I think it's important to kind of take a phenomenological approach to that. And I also think that the effects of those used goods circulating in Palestinian homes and, you know, on people's bodies as they wear Israeli used clothes can't be kind of predicted just on the basis of what the origin was of those objects. So they were often used as kind of tools for upward mobility for within Jenin society. There were ways of adorning a home or someone's body that would kind of give you a cultural capital, especially in this very, very depressed economy that Jenin has had for the last couple of decades. So I think paying attention to those, to the phenomenology and the effects of colonial goods circulating in colonized spaces is an important thing we can do as anthropologists.
I think a similar argument you make in chapter 3, which is called Accumulation and deals with the ways that communities around the landfill site understand and critique the problems that the landfill and waste infrastructure poses for them. Part of this phenomenal understanding is thinking about the ways that these critiques aren't actually often articulated in terms of environmental justice or even environmentalism in general. So how did residents in this place talk about the accumulation of waste in their villages?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that was most interesting was that on the one hand, it was clear to the people in this village of Shukba that I focus on in chapter 3, it was clear that this was an environmental problem, the fact that they were the site of accumulation, the accumulation of waste from Israeli settlements and industries and Palestinian hospitals, for example. The problem was environmental in the sense that it was pollution, but what they were seeing was causing pollution. But their kind of critique of it didn't remain at that level. So I think that was partly because wastes are always attached to humans who created them, and therefore kind of indexed human presence even when the humans who produced them were not there, which meant that there was a sense that the fact that there were villagers who were also benefiting from the waste dumping by allowing trucks to dump on their lands in exchange for cash was just as important as the fact that the Israelis were dumping on a Palestinian village. And I found that the sense of betrayal that the people of this village felt vis-a-vis their own fellow villagers was the most powerful sense that they carried around with them. And in addition to their sense of being neglected by the Palestinian Authority, which was failing over and over again to provide protection against this or to clean up the accumulation, which was not even in the realm of possibility. Just stopping the dumping would have been a major accomplishment. But I think those senses of betrayal at the local level and also by Palestinian government struck me as more important than the environmental justice kind of blaming the source, the original source in some sense of the waste.
One of the themes that emerges here is also this idea about uncertainty around toxicity and the difficulty that residents had evidencing the exposure to toxic materials they had. So what forms of toxicity were people exposed to, and why was it so hard for them to prove this in any way that could catch on?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I can only make statements that were based on what my interlocutors also understood, and they lived in so much uncertainty. So I can say that at the level of their bodies, they were seeing higher rates of cancer. They were seeing respiratory illness, skin issues, diseases, infertility, impotence in men. So they were seeing signs on their bodies on the one hand, which reminds us of the kind of story of birth defects in places like Iraq, where, you know, it's evident that there is a problem to the mother who gives birth to a child with birth defects. But the question of how you connect that to a particular origin, toxic origin, is much more complicated, especially when there are conditions of war, or occupation in this case. So the people I talked to had a very strong sense that these things they were seeing on their bodies were connected to these huge waste mountains that were often being burned, sometimes for up to 3 months at a time, just constant fire coming out of, and smoke coming out of these dump sites. So they knew that there was a relationship, but they couldn't easily trace what it was in those mountains of garbage that was the source of any one of these problems.
This really reminds me of work by our colleague Vasiliki Touliotis on the effects of war in Lebanon as well, and the kind of uncertainties around cancers and birth defects and exposures that has happened there. But you you theorize this as a form of dispossession by accumulation. So can you say a bit about what you mean by that and what intervention you're hoping to make with that concept?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to point to the way that waste has this effect of ontologically sort of taking up space, both by taking up healthy space and by taking up actual space. So when I think of actual space, I think of the trash mountains that now mean that land is no longer land, essentially. It is something else, but it's also not a place where anyone could reside. So it's a third thing. Sometimes this has been referred to as the kind of sacrifice zone. But on the other, so there's that way of taking up space, which also takes place when the Israeli military demolishes a home, for example, and leaves the home in place so that the family can't rebuild there without investing a great deal of money to clean the space. So suddenly that plot of land has been sort of taken off the map. There's that kind of accumulation that causes dispossession because people necessarily either lose their land or both lose their land and have to leave. And then there is the kind of dispossession by toxicity, where several people I spoke with in the village of Shukba had thought very seriously about leaving the village and living in the city, for example, of Ramallah, where they would feel safer and further away from the dioxins that are being emitted by the fire of the mountain. So I think, you know, we often think about accumulation by dispossession. And I thought the reversal of that phrase would help help us really understand the way that waste is uniquely in some ways placed to add to dynamics of dispossession.
The other kind of big conceptual argument running through this chapter is about the dynamics of hypo-governance and hyper-governance. So can you say a bit about what that dynamic involves and how it's present in environmental contamination and waste management politics?
Yeah, I was trying to address an unsettled feeling I had whenever I would read depictions of Palestine through an Agambenian lens, that understood it as a kind of a camp or a space of exception, a space where bare life was the kind of human condition for Palestinians, because there are so many ways in which Palestinians, for example, even in a place like Shukba, this village, which has mostly on area C land, so is directly under Israeli control, even in those spaces, Shukbans are constantly governed in some ways by the Israeli regulations or ad hoc prohibitions on their movement or on the movement of their wastes, on the one hand, and on the other hand, they are kind of abandoned by Israel or neglected. And at the same time, they're both governed in some sense by the Palestinian Authority, which does have a police force and now actually even has a police headquarters inside the village. But on the other hand, they don't receive the help that they need from the Palestinian Authority. So there's a kind of neglect and presence at the same time. And I think accounting for the presence part, in addition to the neglect, was my attempt to speak back a little bit to ideas of abandonment that might miss out on the ways in which there are expectations among Palestinians that they will be governed by certain structures, whether or not they like those structures.
In chapter 4, which is called Gifted, you look at the kind of self-built infrastructure that's emerged around food waste and the ethics that govern the creation of that. So can you recount how you first came to notice the circulation of bread waste in Palestinian cities and how this urban form of exchange has added an extra layer on top of the city's already existing infrastructures?
Yeah, I think this was a funny part of the fieldwork because I spent my first few years doing fieldwork ignoring the bread that was deposited all across urban spaces. It was hanging off of dumpster handles and window grates and fire hydrants, even in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem. It was in alcoves, wall alcoves, and on ledges all around me. But for a long time, because I had spent so much time in my initial field work working with experts and engineers who didn't see this, it was just, this practice was just invisible to them. I also kind of refused to see it myself. And finally, for writing the book, I decided I had to take it into account because it was such a prevalent form of waste management that was being practiced across the West Bank. In terms of how it has added a layer or it adds a layer of infrastructure to the existing infrastructures, I've mentioned where the bread, which is bread people don't want for various reasons because they have too much bread and they're going to buy fresh bread tomorrow or because bread is starting to go stale or starting to go moldy. There is a kind of ethical, moral injunction for Palestinians not to throw bread away in the garbage. So this is their solution. And I found it really interesting that in placing bread outdoors in the hopes or with the thinking that it's possible that someone else might take it, they were creating an infrastructure that was layered onto these other urban infrastructures. And the reason I say it's an infrastructure, this bread, is that it has been facilitating. It facilitates the flow of people. So people move across space to touch the bread or to consider taking it or to take it for their animals, for example. And it facilitates the circulation of this idea that there is a collective out there with a shared sensibility, ethical kind of sensibility around bread. And I think I was particularly struck when I stayed in an Airbnb once in Ramallah and the instructions for taking out the garbage, they just said, there's no recycling in Palestine. Take your garbage out to the street dumpster at the end of your stay. And there was no discussion of what one should do with bread. And after I did a lot of research about the bread, I realized yeah, there's a sense in which this is a kind of national collectivity or an internal collectivity with an ethical orientation toward bread. And it's not seen as something everyone needs to be instructed in, like the foreign guest who's staying at an Airbnb, but rather a kind of anonymous collective. And the reason that matters, an anonymous collective that is nevertheless somewhat nationally shaped. And I think that matters partly because there's been a lot written and said about the fact that the post-Oslo period and the post-Second Intifada period in Palestine have been characterized by the collapse of the national movement. So there's a prevailing critique of the lack of a kind of solidarity or a sense of national belonging as the promise of Oslo statehood has kind of faded, but nothing has come in its place to improve the situation.
So bread's not just something that's really complicated morally to dispose of, but it's also, you write, really complicated to receive and to take because of the decades of humanitarian intervention that have taken place there. Gift economies are very complicated. So can you explain how this history of humanitarianism has shaped the way that Palestinians interpret the act of both giving and receiving this bread?
Yeah, I'll start by saying that I was once in a bakery, and I was talking to one of the employees in the bakery who was explaining that they had put in a corner a sign over some bread that said that anyone in need could take that bread. And the idea was that, people who are struggling financially would walk over to that area of the bakery and take the bread. And he explained to me that that sign had quickly been taken down after the manager of the bakery realized that people were embarrassed to walk up to that corner of the bakery to take the bread. And in a similar sort of dynamic, at a restaurant, that was in Ramallah, and a similar dynamic at a restaurant in Bethlehem, I was told by the owner of the restaurant that he likes to give the extra bread from each day's business to people who come by who are in need, but he puts it in a black plastic bag and kind of gives it to them with discretion, exactly because there would be embarrassment around them showing that they need bread, which is also one of the most fundamental elements of Palestinian cuisine and is relatively cheap. So there's a way in which it's particularly indicative of a person's financial standing for them to not even be able to afford bread. And what I found was interesting about these moments was that they really stood in contrast to what I understood was the dynamic, for example, during the first Intifada in the late 1980s, when there were open channels of sort of mutual welfare provision among people, and they were across classes and across the geography of the West Bank, so that everyone knew who was in need in a neighborhood and openly gave them what they needed, whether it was bread or milk or something else, during really heavy incursions, for example, by the Israeli military. And thinking back to the earlier kind of longer durée of humanitarian aid in Palestine, including the setting up of Palestinian refugee camps across the Middle East and also in the West Bank and Gaza, I understood that the kind of sense of shame I was seeing in the 2009 and after years was a kind of shift, marked a kind of shift in the sensibilities around receiving aid, even from other Palestinians. And I think that partly resonates with a general critique that also circulates among Palestinians in Palestine of the humanitarian aid industry, which has been shaping politics and in some ways creating forms of dependence on itself with uncertain or dubious political ramifications. So I think the critique of being dependent on aid has kind of dovetailed with a kind of shame around being dependent and also around failing to live a kind of normal life, which was the ideal promoted by the Palestinian Authority when it was established and then kind of reinvigorated after the Second Intifada in 2007 and after that.
So the final chapter is called Leakage, and it looks at a much less appealing form of waste, taking us into sewage. But it really focuses in on the idea of a shared environment that has shaped sovereignty in Palestine. So what is this idea of a shared environment? What does it refer to, and how has it come to prominence in the wake of the Oslo Accords?
Yeah, this idea emerged especially in the early 1990s as there was movement toward a set of agreements that would end the First Intifada. And it was kind of worked through by collaborations between Israeli and Palestinian environmental experts and sometimes by outside environmental and water experts like people from the United States. And the idea was that there could be, there was hope in understanding the West Bank as an environment shared between Israel and the now, the nascent at that time, Palestinian Authority, because cooperation around environmental protection, especially around the aquifer, which flanks from below the West Bank and Israel, that could somehow that kind of partnership could create a buffer against other kinds of political tensions. And in fact, the idea of a shared environment was perceived and continues to be perceived as an apolitical or non-political way of understanding the West Bank, which privileges peace. And I, as you see in the chapter, I worry based on my understanding of the way that Palestinian Authority and NGO and other members of the Palestinian community are kind of forced into the participating in this imaginary.
So you talk about that as a kind of creating a double bind that Palestinian officials have to operate within. Mm-hmm. So what effect does that have on the actual operations of the Palestinian government?
Yeah, I mean, I found, for example, that the Palestinian Authority wastewater department, the people who are working on trying to find ways to better manage Palestinian sewage, end up promoting or supporting projects that are in line with this environmental imaginary of a shared environment, but that do not actually meet the needs of the majority of Palestinians who need their sewage to be treated. So the example I give in chapter 5 is of a small series of projects up in the northern West Bank that are on the boundary with Israel, where the idea was that Palestinian villages would be connected by a sewer system, a series of pipes to Israeli communities on the other side, which happen to be actually Palestinian communities, but they are Palestinians with Israeli citizenship in most cases, and the sewage would be treated inside Israel. And this was so captivating to the Japanese donor in that case as a kind of peace project because it crossed the boundary between the West Bank and Israel, which is perceived to be the boundary between Palestine and Israel, and therefore to be which is perceived then as a kind of bridge, literally, of hope and collaboration between the two entities. And I found that my Palestinian Authority interlocutors were doing that kind of project partly in order to project a kind of good neighborliness and environmental friendliness to their donor and donor representatives and to Israel, while meanwhile they were unable to push forward wastewater treatment plants for much, much larger population centers like Tulkarem, Nablus, Ramallah, Jenin, etc. But there was this idea that maybe by moving through less helpful projects like that boundary crossing one, they could eventually get closer to achieving their goals for the larger wastewater treatment plants. But there was this way in which they were also kind of compelled to perform an environmental friendliness that always struck me as really challenging, because I could see why they felt the need to perform that in order to gain a kind of respect in the eyes of the donors and the Israelis who favored the idea of a shared environment. But meanwhile, they were unable to make kind of nation-based claims about what their own constituents needed most.
So the multiple forms of waste management that we see throughout the book are evidence of what's called the phantom state. Can you maybe explain that idea and say a bit about how people use it and what analytical purchase it gives you for understanding the state of waste siege?
Yeah, I heard that phrase for the first time while sitting in a butcher shop in Nablus in the Old City in the fall of 2009. And it was the butcher who said it to me. He said something like, here we're governed by a state that exists but doesn't do what it needs to do. That was the sort of general idea. And I was really fascinated by that idea that there was a presence despite failure. And I think that is the main kind of effect I saw waste siege having. I mean, there were, as you said, there were so many effects of the multiple forms of waste that are kind of piling up in the West Bank. But above all, maybe what matters politically most is that many people attributed what their burdensome conditions to this kind of presence of the Palestinian Authority despite its failure. And I think analytically for me, that was important because I was writing at a time when, or I started the project at a time when the Palestinian Authority's failure seemed like it meant we should sort of dismiss the Palestinian Authority's existence altogether, or we should focus on the ways in which it is effective, for example, when it collaborates with the Israelis to subdue Palestinian protests against the occupation. But the kind of, I wanted to open up a space for thinking about ineffectiveness and presence at the same time, which is something I call kind of matter of factness in the book. And I think that is something we could take to other contexts where we see failures, for example, in Lebanon, where the protests around trash have been great and indict the government for failure. But of course, in failure, there's something is produced. And I think paying attention to the way something is produced, what is produced is important. And in particular, the connection between waste siege and that matter of factness or the phantom state for me was that when in an accumulation site like Shukba, for example, people experience this these accumulations of waste, those accumulations themselves come to sort of condense and index the failed but matter-of-fact presence of the Palestinian Authority. So people come to feel governed in the very moment of the failure of governance, and the toxicities and the uncertainties and the physical sensory experiences of the waste itself become the kind of content of what the Palestinian Authority is as it fails. So I think that's the way in which I see waste siege and the phantom state as kind of two sides of one sheet of paper or two sides of a coin.
There's so much more we haven't had the chance to talk about in the book. But to wrap things up, the final question I wanted to ask, I think, gets back to this idea of thinking beyond Palestine as an exception. So I'm curious what lessons and concepts from this ethnography you think are the most mobile and will be particularly important for researchers working on infrastructure, abandonment, slow violence, toxicity, and some of the other themes that run through the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think in addition to some of the things we've already mentioned, like this idea that used goods from the global north can be something in addition to forms of colonial dumping, or that toxicity can be a problem that we think of through lenses in addition to the lens of environmental justice, again, paying attention to the phenomenological experiences of our interlocutors. I think one methodological point I hope will be mobile, and it's very simple but meaningful for me, which is that because when we think about conditions of indigenous or otherwise marginalized populations in relation to waste, we usually think of them again in terms of environmental justice, and in that context, usually in terms of the waste inputs those communities receive from outside. So I'm thinking of places like Detroit and Chicago, where communities of color are exposed disproportionately to wastes, or to, you know, New Mexico and nuclear wastes near indigenous communities. We think much less of the ways in which those communities experience their own wastes and produce and consume wastes in certain ways that might be invisible if we think primarily in terms of kind of the toxic dumping model, which has been relatively dominant for thinking about for marginalized communities. Then if we take waste siege kind of beyond the scale only of the most disproportionately affected, we can also think of it kind of in practical or ontological terms as a condition whereby wastes are ontologically growing in volume on the planet. And I think that once we recognize that and see waste as a kind of ecology or as the environment or as a part of the environment, I think that challenges us to ask new questions about what we mean when we say environment, or what we mean when we say pollution, and therefore also how we think about the kind of always imperfect ways in which we're going to move forward to try to improve life on this planet.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. Before we go, I just wanted to ask what you're working on at the moment.
Thanks. I'm very excited to be working on a new book that is in some ways quite different. It is an ethnography of Airbnb in Greece. So I'm particularly interested in the worlds of the owners, investors, hosts, designers, lawyers, real estate agents, the kind of behind the scenes elements of Airbnb that have been somewhat less explored. While there's been fabulous work done on the fact that it's generating really terrifying and powerful forms of gentrification, for example, across the globe and in Greece in particular. On the one hand, and I also think that a certain amount of attention is paid to the guest experience of Airbnb. So I'd like to kind of tell the story of how this, how a kind of ecosystem of people and things and forms of property and wealth are coming together through the proliferation of Airbnb in Greece. And the last thing I'll say is that because the Greek real estate market value in that market values dropped so dramatically during the crisis, and Airbnb kind of appeared at the same time to provide a kind of way for generating income out of real estate, Greece has seen a huge influx of international investors in its real estate, and also people who are investing in real estate in order to put their properties on Airbnb. So I've ended up following some of those investors out to Israel, because Israel is actually one of the largest sources of those investors, along with China, Russia, and Turkey. So I'm excited to see where the research goes, but it's becoming multi-sided, and we'll see kind of how, in fact, I'll draw the boundaries around it.
That sounds like a really great project. I'm so excited that someone's working on that. I always think about that when I'm staying in an Airbnb about what's the economy that makes this possible.
Yeah.
So thanks again for taking the time to talk and for the book. It's a really fantastic piece of work. And I just want to say congratulations again. And thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.